Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Paul Kitagaki Jr.'s work as a photographer has taken him all over the world to see people and places that have been new and surprising and meaningful to him and many other people, in fact. But for nearly the past 15 years, he has been tapping into history that enveloped his own family. He's examining the lives and the experiences of Japanese Americans during World War II. Out of that research came a traveling exhibit. You might remember it. We've talked about it on Insight. It's titled Gambatte, Legacy of an Enduring Spirit. And then this past September, he released a beautiful book titled Behind Barbed Wire. It received a second place award in the 2019 International Photography Awards Professional Documentary Book. And I'm very happy to have Paul back with us in the studio today. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Beth, for having me.
Let's start with a little bit of the history and the number of people who were removed from their homes in that time period of March to August of 1942.
Yeah, there was over 110,000 Japanese Americans that were taken forcibly removed from their homes. And the really interesting thing is 2/3 of them were American citizens.
We're coming up on an important anniversary of that time with the date February 19th.
Yeah, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 on February 19th, 1942, which forcibly removed all the Japanese Americans from the West Coast states. That would be California, Oregon, and Washington.
Your personal connection to all of this was through your parents, your aunt, your family members, but this wasn't something that you knew growing up. They didn't talk about it, did they?
No. I mean, like so many, I'm a Sansei, third generation Japanese American. Like so many of my generation, our parents really didn't speak about this. And so many of the subjects that I've photographed and interviewed their parents, they wanted to know what their parents had spoken about too. So it was a common theme and really interesting.
So let's talk about what this book does. You just alluded to it. I call it a then and now. And the then was history found in a lot of photographs. And the now is the way you tried to complete the story.
Yeah. So what's really interesting, all the Japanese Americans had to wear a tag with a number. So everybody is really reduced to like a number. And when I first learned about this, I was in 10th grade. And I was taking an American history class in San Mateo. And I was really shocked because my parents had never, you know, they never talked about this. And I wanted to know more. And even when I asked them what happened, they just said, well, we went to these camps. It was cold. The food was bad. But they really didn't speak from the heart how it affected them and their family. So I later found out that my uncle told me that Dorothea Lange had photographed our family, and she's like one of my photographic heroes. So when I was in Washington, D.C., there's the National Archives, and I searched through these boxes of photographs of Dorothea Lange, and I call them shoe boxes, but they're little 4x5 pictures of her, and on the back's a caption. And most of the captions had like no names, no identity. It would have a place and a time, but we wouldn't know who the people were in the photographs. So later on, I found this book that was called Executive Order 9066, put out by the California Historical Society in 1972. It was like the first book that really gave a visual presentation of what happened. Mm. And those images are so iconic, and a lot of them were Dorothea Lange's images. And when I was back at the National Archives, I really wanted to know what happened. I saw these faces, you know, staring up at me from the boxes of pictures, and I really wanted to know their story, and maybe I could have a complete picture. Maybe I could fill in some blanks about my family and the whole Japanese-American experience.
The picture of your family was in those boxes, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was in one of the last boxes I found. It was a picture of my grandparents and my dad and my aunt. And then there's this white lady was leaning over at him, and my grandparents are smiling. I'm like, why is my grandparents smiling? Why are they smiling? It's not a happy time. And later on, I learned to find out that was their family friend, Dorothea Hightower, and she'd come to say goodbye to them. And her family had also stored a lot of their personal belongings when they were sent away from Oakland, California.
That picture is on page 60 in your book. And this is a great example of what you've been able to do in capturing words and photos, because on page 61, they have returned Kimiko and Kiyoshi, who is Paul Kitagaki, who's your dad, has returned to the site in Oakland. Tell me the story about working with them and piecing this together.
Once I had the historical photograph, I had to really figure out where the exact location was where all the Japanese Americans were rounded up. There's also two other pictures of my Aunt Kimiko standing by the luggage. And there's also another picture of my Uncle Nobu, who started the library in the Tanfran Assembly Center, which was in San Bruno, California. But this is like one of the first photographs I did. And it was really kind of cool because this is like a place that we drive by all the time in Oakland, because we'd go to the Chinatown there. It was near Chinatown. And the Oakland's Buddhist Temple, which is where they stored my family's belonging to. And my family lived back there when they returned to Oakland from the camps. But to learn that spot was still there and bring my dad and my aunt in the same spot, it was really pretty incredible to have them standing there. I'm not sure if we all knew the significance of it at the time, but it was just really maybe a full circle thing, coming back full circle.
But that's what you did over and over in this book, is you took a moment in time from 1942 or somewhere in that area and then brought people back to a place, a connection. I can only imagine how powerful that was for them, for you, how it opened you, how it opened them. I'd like to hear more about that.
One of my subjects, Mason Tachibana, he was from Los Angeles, but he spoke about how when he was a child, they went to this Japanese Catholic church in Los Angeles called Mary Knoll. And he goes, that was like one of the happiest times of his life. He would go there, but the reason why he went there was his dad wanted him and his sister to learn Japanese, how to speak Japanese. So that's where they went. He goes, it was really a happy time. But he said when they had to leave to go to Manzanar and the camps, he goes, it was just like one of the most heartbreaking times of his life. He couldn't believe all this had happened to him. And he got really emotional. It brought up all these feelings that he had long lost buried. And he got very emotional during the interview, and he was very apologetic. I said, no, it's okay. But he ended up later on in life becoming a social worker. And I asked him, you think that because that experience of other people helping you and your family after the war, that might have contributed? And he goes, yeah, maybe it could have happened, you know, been part of his journey that helped him.
Can I take you back to 10th grade when you were still awakening to what this was? Did you put that together from reading yourself? Did someone ask you? How were classmates? How was the teacher? What was that awakening?
I think as I can remember, it was 1970, and I think there's only like one paragraph in the history book, right, about this experience. And I was really shocked, and I was really hungry for more information. I think at the time, there's one other book at the time called Americans Concentration Camps. So I was really hungry for more information because my parents weren't talking about it. And I was kind of like, how can they do this to them? They're American citizens. How can this happen in America? And that at the time, that was because people were really not talking about this, that their generation, the Nisei, the second generation, they really didn't speak about that. They just held everything inside themselves. So it was really hard to find out more information. But
you were aware that family members had been in a camp.
So, yeah, let's say when we're a kid, we go to the grocery store, like the Japanese grocery store in San Francisco or San Mateo, and my parents might see somebody there, and that their common question for that generation, hey, what camp were you in? And so, you know, you say, oh, and I was a Boy Scout, right, an Eagle Boy Scout. I'm like thinking, and, you know, we go camping. I'm like, oh, camping's got to be fun, right? And that was their common thing, but it didn't register with my brain at the time because I'm just a teenager. I really didn't know that they were put in these concentration camps, incarceration camps.
So then in 10th grade, you realized that it was a much different camp than you understood.
Yeah, and since then, it's always had this burning thing inside of me. I wanted to know more. I wanted to be able to tell their stories, not just my family stories, but the whole, you know, Japanese community story. I want to have a whole body of work that would, because everybody's, there's rich people, poor people, people that are treated well, people that weren't, people that lost everything, people that had people from the community help support them and they had something to come back to. There are so many different kind of people. So I want to learn all that and put that together as a, you know, total story on the experience. And personal too, because, I mean, you see the photographs, but you don't know who they were. And now we've put a name in a sort of a personal history of that, each of the family, those historical images.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Paul Kitagaki Jr. His words and photographs are in what is truly a stunning and powerful coffee table style book. It's titled Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. Words matter. And you chose incarcerated over interned.
Yeah, there are so many different terms. I mean, I even asked my subject, what was it? Because the official government term was called a war relocation center. And then they, through most of my life, everybody said internment camp. But other people have said incarceration camps. Some of my subjects said prison camps. Some said concentration camps. So there's so many different words for the same thing that would happen. And it was just, so I chose incarceration camp.
Because?
From some of the community, the Japanese American Citizen League, they did a whole new vocabulary of the words, the meanings of words, and trying to get things changed instead of internment camp. And that was the word they felt was the most proper word to use.
So does using the word internment minimize to some Japanese Americans the experience that they and their family members had?
I don't know. If you talk to most of the people in the second generation, my parents' generation, the Niseis, most of them will say internment camp, or they'll just say camp.
Mm-hmm.
But then some of my subjects, they said it was a concentration camp because we were behind barbed wire. There was guns. The guns were pointing, guard tiles were pointing in to the camp, not outside of the camp. So who's protecting who, you know? So there's some of my subjects said, yeah, it's a prison camp or a concentration camp. They go, it wasn't like in Europe where they, you know, had the death camps where they put everybody, but you're still locked behind barbed wire and you had no rights.
We talked previously in 2015 about your exhibit, Gambate, Legacy of an Enduring Spirit. And I guess it had a five-month run at the Japanese American Nation Museum in National Museum in Los Angeles. There are also images, or at least one, that was part of an exhibit at the Smithsonian. I remember you talking about a poster. And I remember seeing the poster that had a number of faces, people that you were still looking for, faces from a photograph.
Yeah. You know, when I first started the project, it started here in Sacramento.
Right.
I had a poster board with maybe 15 of the iconic images, and I took them to the Japanese Buddhist temple for the summer bazaar. And I thought, oh, somebody's going to recognize some of these people because they're from Sacramento. And I got not one call. So then somebody said, hey, you need to go to this Japanese Methodist church in Sacramento because they do this lunch for all the seniors. So I took the same board down there, and then somebody recognized somebody and went in the photograph. So it started from there. And it's grown since when we had the first exhibit at the California Museum in 2015. I had maybe 30 pairs, historical and the contemporary photographs. The exhibit that we just have, or my current exhibit, has 60 people. So it's really grown, and we're still looking for more places to exhibit that work.
You are using a special black and white film and a large format camera so that you have the look of the photographs taken by Dorothea Lange and others.
Yeah, I thought it was very important to shoot with film and a 4x5 camera, film camera, which is kind of the same sort of format they used back in the 40s, because I wanted the pictures to feel the same, have the same kind of feeling, even though they were taken here over 70 years later. I want them to kind of have a marriage, a match of before and after. So you weren't shot, you know, I just wanted that marriage of that to come together.
One of the stories was repeated by some of the people, folks who were jailed after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Jimmy Yamaichi?
Yamaichi,
yes. Was one of the draft resistors who ended up on trial. Will you tell a bit of his story?
Yeah, Jimmy, he ended up in Tule Lake, which is where the segregated camp is, which is his brother was drafted in the Army. So his brother was already serving in the U.S. Army. But Jimmy felt that he was locked behind barbed wire, and he felt that his citizenship rights were taken away. So when this thing came out for the draft, he said, no, I'm not going to go draft unless you're going to let me out and return home and restore my rights. So he and a few other guys had to go to a trial in Eureka, California. And he argued to the judge that we're locked behind barbed wire. We don't have our rights, and we don't have freedom of choice. And so the judge agreed with him and dismissed the charges against him, which was unlike there's 63 guys in Heart Mountain, Wyoming. The same thing, they resisted the draft, and the judge there threw them in a federal prison. So they were in federal prison until way after the war ended for draft resisting.
A number of people you spoke with, and I think this is a really important point, Paul, express concerns that they don't want what happened to them to happen to anyone else. But there have been and continue to be times of mass hysteria in our country. There are times when groups of people, we all know it's contemporary, have been isolated or segregated, pushed out or pushed in different directions. What about this persistent desire to never have this happen again?
Yeah, mostly every subject I spoke to said they want to speak out about this because they want people to know the story. Because a lot of the story that the incarceration of the Japanese Americans during World War II, it's really not in a history book anywhere. It's hard for people to know this information across the country. I mean, we know it more on the West Coast, but, you know, people on the East Coast, the South, and Midwest, they really don't know the story. So they felt it's so important for them to speak out so this doesn't happen again. And even today, like last year, the Japanese Americans, there was a protest at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, because that's where they wanted to put some of the immigrant children separated from the families, and they put them. So there's a protest there, and then this June there's going to be a protest rally in Washington D.C. on closing the camps because they don't want people the same thing to happen to another ethnic group.
What do you want to keep doing with this history and the weaving of then and now?
Well, I'm still the book has come out, but last year I photographed 5 more people. I'm still looking for more people to add to the body of the work. I'm also trying to do another project with the campsites that I haven't started yet. So I'm trying to work on that, and I'm still trying to share the story more places, just be, you know, all across the United States and hopefully in other countries.
Let's direct everybody, even though we'll post a link to the website, to look for people that you're looking for and to help be part of this participation effort.
Thank you. My website's kitagakiphoto.com, KITAGAKIPHOTO.com.
And you're still working at the Sacramento Bee besides all of that.
Yes, I still have a full-time job as a photojournalist. I've been a photojournalist for 42 years. I'm very lucky to have this life.
Well, thank you for staying connected with us as your work goes on. And this conversation will be linked on our website. Hopefully, it will move and be shared with people as well as this work that you've done continues. And I imagine it to be a lifelong project for you.
Thank you. Yes, it's definitely a lifelong project. And thank you for sharing the story.
Mm-hmm. That is Paul Kitagaki, Jr. His book is titled Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. You'll find those links at capradio.org/insight. And after a short break, we're going to continue the conversation about this era as Christian Kiefer talks about his novel Phantoms, which is set in Placer County, where he grew up. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.